Okay, so good morning, everyone. We can start with introductions. We'll start here at DOE. Myself, Ann Glass, I'm DOE's Medicaid consultant.
I'm Thomas Garrett. I'm a systems analyst in the Bureau.
Hi, this is Mary Walsh, the program specialist for OTPT and SLP.
And so, AKASAP. AKASAP, are you able to talk? We're not hearing anything. Amy, can you text me? Make sure that you called. You entered the organizer pin when you got on the call. Sorry, guys. We're in two different locations. So, Amy, can you hear me? Okay, let's just give this just a second while we're waiting for Amy. We can't hear you. If you didn't, oh, she says we're muted. If you called in with the, did you call in with the organizer pin after you entered your conference room number? Because that's what allows you to talk. If you didn't, if you can hang up and call in again, I'm going to text you the organizer pin if you need it. Okay, so Aka's going to try to call back in again. Okay, so I am going to, do we need to take it off recording and start recording? Okay, so I'll wait and see. So Amy, we hear you talking. Richard Geary is also muted. He is also on the call. He's our software developer for the Emacs and works with us in the Medicaid tracking system.
We're here.
Okay, great. Okay,
awesome. Hey, this is Amy.
You want to introduce yourself to everybody? We may have new people on the call, so if you'll tell them who you are and what you do.
Sure. This is Amy Flanagan, and I handle the school-based administrative claiming portion, the financial portion of this.
And good morning. This is Leela Jett. I'm the school health monitor.
And I'm Martin Fanberg. I'm the subject matter expert in the policy.
And that's all of us here so far this morning.
All righty. So just a few call reminders. So we're going to give you a couple of call reminders this morning. If you will put your name and the district or company that represented in the chat box. The phone lines will be muted during the call, so please enter your questions in the chat box. Since we are recording this call, we will read the questions from the chat box. Some of the questions we've learned in the past, we don't have immediate answers for. So if we're not able to answer them right there, one of us, AKA staff or DOE staff, will let you know that we'll research it and then get back to everybody. And again, we will pause periodically during the call to answer those chat box questions. So we're going to go on to the first slide, which is AKA. And I'm assuming, AKA, that you can see all this, all the slides. We're on the fee-for-service rule revision update.
Yes. Hi.
What? Fee-for-service rule revision. I'm sorry. I spaced away there for a second.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, the fee schedules have been updated to reflect the current NCCI edits, and they are in FMMIS. I don't can't really tell you if there'll be another workshop right now. We'll take questions about it and get back to you on that. And we'll certainly notify everyone if and when there is another workshop.
So the bottom line, it sounds like, Marty, is we don't have a date yet or know when that the new rule for fee-for-service will go into effect. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Okay, next slide. I'm assuming that you all have okay, this is all fee-for-service information. I think that I need to do the first bullet. I think I meant to take this bullet out because I'm addressing it in a different slide. So let's just leave that AAC services out right now. And Marty, if you want to go ahead and take the next three bullets.
Sure. The fee-for-service reimbursement reports are being reviewed right now and updated, and I think consistent with what you had sent out, Anne, as far as asking all of the different districts to look over the numbers and see if they find any anomalies that would be helpful.
Okay, Marty, I apologize. I had a slide left in here from the last call, so this is that's why you seem taken by surprise. Somehow that other slide was left in there. So
that did have something we were going to discuss on it, though, but I'll touch on that later, Anne.
Okay. So, Marty, now we have the questions up from the districts, which covers some of the subjects that were just in the old fee-for-service slide.
Reduction in billable units, that is being worked on right now. Let me read the other one, billable both of those are being looked at and worked on at this moment. We'll have an answer back to you shortly.
Okay.
All right, so as far as charter schools, we've started a pilot program with a few charter schools to develop the enrollment process. We are, again, going back to the rule, we are in the process of finalizing all of this. Charter schools that do wish to participate need to first get an NPI number. And once they receive the NPI number, then they can contact provider enrollment and they will assist you in getting a Medicaid ID number. With regard to telemedicine, well, in accordance with the telemedicine policy, all claims that are submitted to the agency for services delivered via telemedicine need to include the GT modifier.
Yeah, Marty, the question was, is the GT modifier in the system?
Yes.
Because at one time it wasn't. It is. Okay.
It's,
so claims should not deny if you're billing for telemedicine.
If claims are sent clean, they will not deny.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Just for a second, Anne, let me you on that, because I know that we had discussed, and I do believe that you sent out an email to all of the districts so that in case they ran into a problem with billing issues, that they know to get in contact with the agency through the complaint line. And again, I think you gave two links. One was a helpful link, and the other one, I believe, is the provider services link. When you click on the provider services link, you'll see claims dispute, and that's where those inquiries would go.
Right, and the other link was to, they call it tips for using the system, and it takes you through what you'll see on the screen when you enter the information in. If you just follow that, I think if you try to just do it without that tip sheet and reading through it, it can be a little difficult. But Marty, I think you explained to me y'all had worked with different people there, and the determination was that this is one way to get, even though it's a complaint, I guess, for a lot of people, but it's also for issues and claims. Claims questions. It's not just complaints about the system.
Right. So there are two avenues that you can go through. One is, you know, if you go to the ACA website, you will see there's a complaint, but then there's another button down below that talks about claims dispute. And you would want to click the claims dispute, and that will take you to the provider services. And within the provider services is another setup for claims disputes. And yes, I would advise everyone to use that, because these folks are set up to troubleshoot any kind of problems. And if something happens where there needs to be a change or something within the system, they will get in contact with us. But these are the people that know what they're doing as far as resolution of claims.
Thank you. And this goes back to how several of you, we had asked, and Marty had asked, and I provided to him. We had the claim line, the ICN number, information about claims that were denying. But, and thank you, Marty, for looking into it and trying to get it resolved without going through this other avenue. But this is how we'll need to do it. Be careful when you're in that website, because when you see that there's something, and I don't have the site up here, but it's either maybe called claims resolution. That's a different set of things where you go in and you're actually arguing something, and there's a charge for that. It's managed by a vendor, and they charge per hour for anything that they have to research. So just make sure that you're in the right section when you go in to put in the information.
And just to piggyback on that, they are the last line. So if in fact you have decided that you know the claim was denied and we don't find any system issues with it, and at the end you still don't agree, then that's where you go with it.
Okay, thank you. Okay, moving on to, just want to talk just a second about AAC concurrence. We've gotten a few calls. Mary Walsh is sitting here with us, who, as she said, is our therapy program specialist. And the question has come up about AAC concurrence, and specifically forms that entities are presenting to school districts. So in a lot of situations, the student is being tested and assessed and receives an AAC evaluation outside of the school by an independent speech language pathologist, and they form an ID team. The requirement for Medicaid durable medical equipment, which is what we call the DME program, the requirement for non-school people in the DME program is that school districts, it requires that school districts concur with a device being proposed if the Medicaid recipient or student is under the age of 21 and is in public school. So what's happening is if this happens outside of the school, it does say in the policy also, the Medicaid policy, that the ID team, interdisciplinary team that's required, should include the teacher, the student, and a few others. But what we've heard from a couple of districts is that might not be happening. And the first they hear of the AAC being needed or being provided to the student is when someone sends or gives what they call a concurrence form to the school. So we discussed it here, and we discussed it with our bureau chief, and we don't have any additional guidance as far as how to handle those concurrence forms when they're requested. So it's going to be up to the district how you handle those forms when they come in. I can tell you that I know of at least one district that when they get a concurrence form like that from an outside entity, that district, their procedure is that they, they have an IEP meeting to discuss it, because it does involve, you know, a little bit of training, I guess, on the teacher's part on what to do with the AAC device, I guess, depending on what it is. So that having been said, the district that sent me their procedure said that we could share that procedure with you all, and we will do that. And if you would, if you have a procedure, or if you could just email me and tell me if you're being presented with these forms, how your district is dealing with them, and then we can post those on our website. So if somebody wants to see, if a district wants to see what other districts might be doing, you know, when they're presented with these concurrence forms, how they're handling it. The other thing I would say is, I think, Mary, you might have heard that some, that now that's if this AAC evaluation is done outside of the school. If it's done inside of the school, you know, when it's the school district staff forming the ID team, that's generally going to be the speech language pathologist, OTPT, and, you know, teachers and the people, that the student and the parents, whoever's on that team, then you don't have to concur with yourself. So there wouldn't be a concurrence form required from the Medicaid. It's not part of the certified school match requirements. If you want more information, I know we're used to looking at our coverage and limitations handbook, which is our Medicaid policy. I know you're used to looking at the therapy and behavioral nursing and transportation, but as a reminder, there is a separate chapter currently in the handbook for AAC services. So, and if you have any questions about that from the school side, just let me know and I will get with Mary and we'll get your questions answered. Okay, moving on to SDAC, Amy and Leela.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So this is Leela Jett. We have had a lot of confusion and issues with titles matching. And because of this, we would like to add an attestation so that we don't have to worry about titles matching anymore, and that whenever I monitor these forms, that no one is going to have any sort of error from having a title that doesn't match. So earlier this morning, we sent out the new attestation, and it's going to read, by submitting this form, I certify that all information provided on the form is accurate, and I understand the purpose of the administrative claiming program. So whenever a participant either signs a paper form or submits an electronic form, that attestation there is going to basically put the responsibility back onto the participant themselves to make sure that that information is correct. So we are no longer going to be looking for matching titles as of quarter two 2019. And I'll try to go a little bit slowly. Anyone has a question, you can put it in the chat box. I can see the chat box. So I will try to keep an eye on that.
Okay, and I just wanted to add, Leela, so there will no longer be the requirement that they enter the title. They're attesting to what's in the system. Is that correct?
Well, most consultants automatically have the title added in. I would leave the title in there. If they want to, I would just, to avoid having any additional changes, because I don't want to, you know, this, that would be a pretty big change, you know, with a short time frame if we added too many changes to this. So I'm fine with the title still being there. I'm just not even going to look for them to match anymore. I am going to be looking at the title at the top like usual to make sure that it's a certified title. The titles will still need to be certified. They will just not need to match perfectly. For example, if a teacher that is a varying exceptionalities teacher just writes teacher, I wouldn't look at it twice. If they write you know, a varying title, I may call just to make sure, but always the way to avoid that is just write, I certify this title. If you see that's different, just go ahead and make a note and I won't call you. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. So the next part toward basically lessening our overall errors, we need to remove all of the examples from the forms. And by examples, I mean the very long list of examples that was originally on the back of the paper RMS forms. I have seen a lot of matching titles, and unfortunately the way it's written now, if the title is verbatim from the examples or from the guide, it becomes a fatal error. So if we get rid of these examples, that's going to remove a lot of room for error. And one of the largest examples I'll see, just to clarify with everyone, is checking if individualized positive behavioral reinforcement procedures have been implemented. That is used directly, and it doesn't have any additional information. And that happened several times last quarter. So if you remove all those examples, that will remove the ability for someone to copy it and for errors. So that's going to be another thing we're looking for by quarter two. Please have all examples removed. I will tell you that there will be, you know, a short amount of time where the examples are still available, and there may still be fatal errors if the examples are verbatim. To clarify, I'm not going to look at any of them that say with a student for a direct therapy service visit. That absolutely, I mean, it would match, but that's plenty of information for me. It's, you know, easy to match that. It's such a common activity, I wouldn't think about it. So just make sure that all of your participants are giving as much information as possible. And especially with these, we want to make sure if they're mentioning any sort of training, that they talk about what the training is and what the purpose of the training is. Because that's another issue I've seen, is they'll say, I was in a training. But you could be missing out if it was a medical training. So we want to make sure that everything is included in the form, that we have as much documentation as possible to justify each code. All right, I don't see any questions, so I'm going to move on to the next one. 7-day response time. So what this is stemming from, we were talking with Anne about this the other day. We're seeing paper form included in samples with electronic forms. And it's come to our attention that the paper forms have become a way of extending the time that a participant has. And we would like to either stick to paper or electronic now. So if your district chooses to have paper forms, all of your forms will be paper. If your district chooses to have electronic, all of them will be electronic. There will be no extensions for putting in your sample moment by changing to a paper form. And because of this, Anne thought it was a good idea to make all of them across the board a 7-day response time. And we agree with this. We think that it's the fairest way to do it. Paper and electronic will both have 7 days. And because the guide does not mention the 30-day extension for paper forms, we're just going to go with what the guide says. So to reiterate, 7-day response time for paper or electronic beginning quarter two of 2019. And that is 7 working days. Not 7 calendar days, 7 working days. This will not change the amount of time that each district has to review their forms and make sure that they're correct and send them back for any additional information. It will only affect the time the participants have to complete the form. Let's see. We have some questions. Yep. Pinella's asked 7 working days. Yes, that's correct. And yes. So we have another question. And we have a couple of different questions coming up. And for one county, we will discuss the paper forms outside of the meeting. I think that would be the best idea. We can all talk about it and kind of find a workaround to how we can make this work for everyone so that it's fair for everybody. And it looks like we have more questions coming in. Yes, absolutely. I just want to make sure that we answer these questions, so I'm giving you another second to add it in before we move on to the next.
Yeah, and Leela, this is Ann. It's my understanding when you say the 7 days, it's just to reiterate what you said. That 7 days for them to actually do their first pass on the form, I mean, to complete the form.
Yes. That is for the participants.
It's not when it has to get back to the district contact and things like that, right?
Yes. And we had a question. After initially completing the form within 7 workdays, there is still additional time for the sample participant to make corrections. That is correct. That time frame will not change. It is only the initial 7 days that everyone else gets for the participant to fill out their response. We have more questions. I'm just going to give it a moment. And actually, while they're asking this question, this next one is just a reminder. I've seen a lot of student names in the sample responses. Please ensure that there are no student names in your responses. That is a potential breach of PHI because you could potentially connect a child's name with a service they're receiving. I see a lot of staff names, but student names is exceptionally worrisome. Please ensure that there are not student names, and I would recommend redacting it if you find them. Okay, let's see. Our question came in. So someone is asking about electronics not completed in 7 days. So all of the electronic systems will automatically take the ability to fill the form out away from participants after 7 days. So literally the system itself gives you 7 days, and then the system is supposed to not allow you after those 7 days to fill your form out. So that's part of the reason why we're saying, out of fairness, 7 days across the board for participants to fill them out. So the next issue I'm seeing, I'm just going to go ahead and move on, and we may go back because there are still questions coming in. But the next bullet point is for school hours. I've seen several moments recently, this quarter, where the school district had not updated their school hours into the system. And so participants were being sampled outside of school working hours. That is diluting your sample. Please make sure that you are updating the school's hours so that we can make sure that we're sampling everyone during the working hours and we can receive good responses, because you could be missing out on activities and flooding it with 13s. So we're going to be removing any form that we find. It's going to be an invalid form, which means a fatal error. We're going to take it out of the pool if we find out that it has been sampled during a time where the school is actually closed. And let's see, we don't have any more questions. So the next couple of questions, I've been asked to talk about the different codes and some of the different, I do see a question about our last one. I'm going to go back. So in a large county, each participant may have varying schedules. That is absolutely fine. We want to make sure that the school hours are correct. And if a participant has varying hours, I would recommend choosing the hours in between them so that they can be sampled during the time that they're at work. They have a better chance of being sampled. So for example, if one day they work 8 to 12 and one day they work 10 to 5, I would try to sample the in-between times that are included in both of their schedules. But I'm really looking for school hours here. So if the school is closed for the day and I see several participants, like say for example, they close at 3 and everyone goes home, and I see several participants at 4 o'clock, 3:15, I'm going to remove those from the sample because those 13s that are in there are just diluting your percentages. Let's see.
Can I give an example, Leela?
Yeah, absolutely.
One example that we saw was that the school schedule the example is the school used to start at 7:25 in the morning, and the school changed this year their school hours beginning at 7:35. We had 7:25, so a sample participant got chosen in that 10 minutes before school started because the school schedule had not been updated. So that's the kind of thing that can happen if you don't have the, at least to the level of the school.
Yeah, that's what we're looking for. And I see that question where folks are asking whether the school is closed versus outside of student hours. No, we're actually looking for the school to be closed. Like, folks have already gone home for the day, and they're being sampled when they're home. Or sampled too early in the morning when they're home.
So when you say school hours, you know, schools can open, like a janitor may get to the school and opens the school at a certain time. But then there's also what some people refer to as the bell schedule, like when that first bell rings.
Janitors are not included in the sample, so we wouldn't be worried about those early hour schedules. We're looking at the main group of people, teachers and medical providers, that are coming into work. So we're looking at those hours.
Right. Thank you.
Let's see. Okay, and just to I've looked at your questions, just to clarify again, we're looking for school hours. And it's also something to consider, if your participant has such a varying schedule that they are consistently getting 13s because they aren't at work, you might want to consider removing them from the pool. If the, you know, just think about how the benefit may outweigh the cost there, because we will remove the forms if it's outside of school hours. But if you're having too many 13s, I mean, just think about how that overall affects your percentage. All right. I don't see any new questions, so we're going to go ahead and move on. This is still up for discussion after this meeting. If you have any questions, you can always call me. But our next section is scheduling. I have seen scheduling generally coded as a 5, but there are some differences. If you are a provider and you are scheduling an appointment for something that is included in the IEP, it is related to the direct service and is a 10. If you are assisting the family, however, with scheduling appointments outside, it could be a 5. So you really want to make sure that the participants are including a lot of information about scheduling. If it is related to direct service, it is a 10. That includes scheduling, that includes any sort of paperwork that's involved in direct service. The next code verification that we're talking about is code 11 versus code 12. A really good way to think about 11 versus 12 is 11 has to do with education and students. I've been seeing a lot of 12s that are coded, and they have everything to do with the student population. If you are working with students, if it has anything to do with education, it's most likely an 11. It's a really good rule of thumb. And 12s are only for administrative activities. So that would be any sort of building functions. And another question we had this last quarter was, bus duty is always going to be an 11, and bus duty even includes monitoring parents on campus. That will not be a 12, that will be an 11, because it is still ultimately related to providing services for students. I don't see any questions coming in, so I'm gonna move on to the next one, 12 versus 13. This is another one that gets confusing, and I can see why, because of the wording. So 12 versus 13. 12 is when you are at work, and 13 should be used when the individual is not working and not being compensated. So this gets confusing because they could be scheduled to work, but they might not be at work. So that's why paid time off is included in a 12. So we want to make sure that 13s have absolutely nothing to do with school. The employee is not at work. They were not scheduled to work. They are not being paid to work, or the position is vacant. I don't see any questions about that.
Lila, let me clarify, because when you said 12, the first thing you said was when they're at work. And then you added, so it's not just if they're at work, it's if they're at work or they're being paid, so they can be on paid leave.
If they're scheduled, yeah. If they're scheduled to work.
Thank you.
Okay, and this is Amy. Since we don't have any other questions about the other ones, I'm going to move on to payroll submissions. Just to let everybody know, I'm going to continue to collect the payroll for each district at least 2 times a year. If I consistently find discrepancies between the district cost allocation and the payroll, your district may be requested to submit more than twice a year. Please be prepared to have it and send it in. The payroll tabs, I've had some questions about how this information needs to be sent in. The payroll tabs that are located on your ESTAC invoice, those can be used, or you can use them as a template for creating an Excel payroll document. The ESTAC invoice tabs have the headers that I need, that I use to sort and filter and create pivot tables, everything that I use to compare the information. So if your spreadsheet has more than that, it's fine. It just can't have less, or I'm going to ask you to resubmit. So, and please keep in mind that when you're claiming salaries and benefits, you should only claim pay that's related to time spent performing duties that fall within the approved job description for in-school hours, like special pay related to before school or to before or after school hours is not to be included. Federal pay is another thing that's not to be included either. The majority of you are really good at making sure that you pull that information out, but I still find on some that it's still left in there. And I just want to make sure that you double check all of this to make sure that you're not including that, because I don't want to have to, you know, every email or phone call is just a delay in getting those funds back to you. So now for non-sampled staff, the only biggest thing I can say is make sure you're prorating. The non-sampled support or supervisory staff, they have to have a direct correlation to the sample pool participants. And if they support or supervise people outside of the pool, you cannot claim their entire salaries and benefits, but only of the amount that's associated with the sample pool participants. I really appreciate all the effort that everybody's already been making in getting this data to me and ensuring I've got some that send cover sheets that state exactly, you know, making you know, stating that I certify that such and such job descriptions have been prorated. And that's, I love that. That just makes my day. So moving on to the sample pool, make sure you're only including.
You have a question, Amy, about the payroll submission.
Okay. Let's see.
Is this a change to the frequency for payroll submission? I understand that the payroll has been submitted quarterly.
Not every single, no. The payroll years ago prior to me was optional and was to be submitted. I mean, in the guide it stated, you know, it's optional, but have it readily available if it's requested. But I started... I really wanted to make sure that we had all information available for the ESTAC in case there were audits, because we have had CMS in here questioning some things, and we just want to make sure that we're all on the up and up and that I can relate the cost, the information that's input on the district cost allocation to the actual payroll. So I just determined a couple years ago that this was going to be requested. It's a mandatory submission twice a year, but I'll determine whenever that, you know, request is, you know, whenever I request it. So, and I think we've got some other questions coming in. Hold on just a second. And some districts do send it in quarterly, and that's wonderful. I check it. So, and I keep copies of all of this, you know, on file just in case there is an audit. I've got everything that I can pull up to make sure that what we are receiving payroll-wise is the same as what's being claimed on the cost. So, let's see.
That's actually a me question.
Okay. I can, Leela, you want to go ahead and address
question? Yeah, while we're waiting for the other questions regarding Amy's statement to come in, we did receive a question. An OT participating in an IEP meeting to discuss OT services is a 5 or a 10 now. So I actually recently went beyond our guide to research this because several folks have asked about it. It's not written specifically in our guide, and of course our guide is all based on federal guidance from CMS. So in the CMS guide, it notes that anything related, let me actually read it, anything related to a medical treatment is direct service. Let's see. So under what CMS considers to be a 5, which is code 9B, page 34 of the CMS guide, it states referral coordination monitoring activities related to IEP services. Activities that are part of a direct service are not claimable as an administrative activity. Furthermore, activities that are an integral part of or an extension of a medical service, for example, patient follow-up, patient assessment, patient counseling, patient education, parent consultation, or billing activities, should be reported under direct services. So I went further from that because I wanted to be absolutely certain. It says parent consultation, and it actually mentions the medical part of the IEP is under a 10 in the CMS guide. So I looked at several other states and found from their guides that that is correct, that any time a medical professional is in an IEP meeting, most states actually count it as direct service. But our guide requests that it is under non-Medicaid, which is code 11. So that is correct. Even if a medical professional is in the meeting, if it's an IEP meeting, it is an 11. And that's because it is related to the direct service that comes from the IEP. I don't see anybody typing any questions, but I'm sure there are questions on that. You can feel free.
There are a couple. I don't know if you've got a delay there, but somebody has said a 5 is oversight of potential treatment for a specific student, ?
Yes, but development of the IEP is an 11. The IEP itself is an 11 because the overarching goal of the IEP is educational. And that's from CMS guide. And that's how all of the other states that I've looked at so far are doing it. So I want to make sure we're consistent with CMS federal standards. And there are still a lot of fives to be had. I mean, IEP meetings is a big part of it. But we want to make sure that we're consistent and we want to make sure that we're reporting this correctly.
And actually, I could kind of tag on to that with regards to the sample pool and also answering Julia Corsini's question. Let me just read through my little sample pool snippet here, and I think that'll probably get you.
Amy, for purpose of the recording, will you read the question that you're going to answer?
Sure. Julia Corsini questions or wanted me to discuss the changes in the RTMS percentages over the last few years, stating that many of the districts have seen a deduction of 3 to 5%. And that is kind of what I wanted to talk about with regards to the sample pool. Make sure you're only including participants that routinely perform Medicaid outreach activities. Each quarter, district liaisons have the opportunity to review the pool before it's sent to the data managers. Use this review to ensure that those individuals are still adequate for the pool. Just because their job description is an approved code doesn't mean every individual with that description and job code performs these activities on a routine basis. These percentage changes have nothing to do with regards to the finance, but I really feel that it's being affected by the dilution of the sample pool with participants who don't routinely perform Medicaid outreach activities. And those individuals need to be removed. That's not saying that, you know, you've got a whole section of people that need to be removed. That just means you need to make sure that you're going back over, looking at your pool, and ensuring that you're not just putting somebody in there because they have a particular job code or a job description. You need to make sure that those people are actually performing these SDEC activities, because if they're in there and they're not performing the activities, then they're not going to be performing anything that's going to assist your percentage rate. So clean up the sample pool, make sure there's good, valid, usable people in there that will actually help those percentages go up.
And just for clarification, the person who asked that question said a deduction. Did you mean a reduction? There's nothing being deducted from stuff now,
yeah.
Is there? Okay.
No, there's not. Yeah, I think it was reduction.
Okay, thank you. There was a question that was missed, I think, up from Chris. So can you clarify the sample participant having access to the moment to make corrections? They cannot have access directly. The person coding can reach out for clarification to code only, correct?
Yes. Yes. But see, with paper forms, that can be a little bit different, which is, I think, maybe where the question's coming from. But yes, that is correct. We're not changing the amount of time you have to complete the forms. It's just the amount of time the participant has to initially fill out the form, which is 7 working days for paper and electronic.
And again, that's the initial.
Yes.
That's the initial getting it done. So I think we're. That could be coming from is systems generally lock the participant out after 7 days. But
right.
We all have ways, I think, of making corrections. So that's not changing that process. It's just.
Right.
Somebody's typing. Let me see what else we have.
And really, if you think about it, I know that it's hard to look at it right now the way that it is, but. If the participant is getting it back to you within 7 days, you're not having to wait that whole 30 days for them to get it back. I'm hoping that this will actually be more helpful in the long run, but like I said, I will discuss that with the paper districts. They can call me afterwards. We can talk about it. All right. We have another question from Richard Gary. It says, are you saying that after the sample participant completed the moment electronically, SB cannot get back into the moment and add clarifying content? No. The 7 days is only for the participants. The system will still work the way it did before, where the participant will not have access to their moment after 7 days. The 7 working days is for the participant to fill out their moment. After that, you will still have the same amount of time to go through and review and code and ask for additional information. It's just that initial time frame of 7 days. And then we're clarifying, does a central coder still need to certify titles? Okay. This new attestation that we added will remove the need for matching titles. But if you see a title that is so drastically different, you feel like you need to make a note of it, I would still absolutely certify it. If you see one that's written out that they're actually two different, like say for example, their moment is for a teacher and they signed as a nurse or something like that, I would just write across the bottom certify it, because otherwise I'm probably going to call you about it and ask you. So just to streamline the process, I would go ahead and certify any that are dramatically different. But like I said, as long as the person that is being sampled is a certified title, I'm not going to have any more errors for matching titles. see. And St. Lucie is asking for an example of a code 5. Off the top of my head, I mean, we have all these examples in the guide. I mean, gathering information that may be required in advance of referrals or evaluation. I mean, you just, the way to look at it is if it's in any way involved in direct service, which includes direct service from the IEP, it's most likely not a 5. Like if the direct service is already being provided or it has specifically something to do with the IEP meeting or developing the IEP, it's not a 5. Assisting and coordinating, scheduling healthcare appointments for the individual or family. I mean, if you're calling and helping a family make an appointment with an outside provider, that's a 5.
Sorry, what we're looking for is for the individual to just type what they're doing. There again, it's the who, what, where, when, and why. And I understand that, you know, the majority of you will be doing the coding. We don't want you to have your participants write for a code.
Right.
Just write what they're doing.
Yeah.
We just need to know what they were doing during the moment that it occurred.
With as much, you know, description of what they're doing as possible. Like, we need as much information as we can get so that we can have this documented. And I mean, just if it's related to child find, if it's related to the IEP, and that's developing the IEP, all the steps of the IEP itself, it's an 11. If it's a 504, it's an 11. We have another question. Once a participant has completed the survey, they should not be asked to go back in, correct, even though they have time. So, from my understanding, the electronic system wouldn't work like that. The paper forms, most likely, from my understanding, you would go back to the participant and ask for additional information. Yeah, if they write it on their form, that's fine. But we're talking about the 7 days for the initial filling out the form. So any time that you need to clarify after that time frame, you know, you're going to use that whole next month to work on the forms and code everything. You can ask for additional information and add to it.
I think this question could be, let's say the person, I think I would direct districts back to there, because this could be a question like it's done, they do it in 3 days. They actually have 7 days. If they need to go make a change or whatever, I think they would need to go through, if it's within that 7 days, go through either their vendors, Emacs, people to find out how to do that. I'm sure their process is established for making corrections.
Right. And there's always the comment box for all of the consultants have a comment box. So that's another way of adding additional information. Let's see.
And Chris clarified that. So the moment, and this is true for all systems, moment is open until the 7 day mark. Unless it's been coding, it's going to be closed at that 7 day mark. So, as you said earlier, Leila.
Right. Are there any more questions about this before we move on? Just want to make sure. Like I said, we can talk about this after the meeting, but we're all here together right now if anyone wants to ask anything else. I know that, okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to move on to the Senate bill.
I was just going to say, I know that right now this can feel overwhelming, but I'm really hopeful that this is going to improve the process for all of us and work toward having more consistency and clarity and better documentation for this program. And I'm so happy to help you however I can. If anyone wants to call me, I absolutely have an open door policy. You can let me know, okay?
Okay, you guys, do you see the question?
So our next question, to get clarification, if a sample participant completes the moment within 7 workdays, oh, it's got something blocking it.
Hold on.
Sorry, we had a notification pop up. It's blocking it. Okay, within 7 workdays, and the 7 workdays have passed, can the moment be unlocked by the district manager for additional clarifying RMS response content to be added? From my understanding, yes, that's in our RMS timeline. After the moments have completed, you have the next month to make changes. So if you need to make a change to that, yeah, absolutely. The 7 days is only affecting the initial participant's response time.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, we weren't going on to the Senate bill. The next thing is the monitoring update. So we're going to that now.
Yes, so on to the good news. I have talked with everyone here, and we have all decided to change our monitoring tool language. I am going to change the design a little bit more to match with this language. I'm going to try to make this more streamlined. I'm going to put it in one document and send it as a PDF so that you don't have multiple documents to save. But the biggest change that we want to get rid of, the term fatal error. I feel like fatal error looks really bad whenever someone who's not aware of what a fatal error is looks at it. For example, superintendents, when you give them your report and they see this information, we want to change the term fatal error to invalid form, because that's really what it is. That form has been removed from your sample pool and does not count anymore. So fatal errors will now be called invalid forms. You will see that beginning Q2 2019. Like I said, there's going to be a few design changes to the monitoring tool, but it's going to be overall the same. It's basically just going to change fatal error. And I'm going to add a couple of different elements to that. But with fatal error changing, we're also changing non-fatal error. It's just going to be an error. And because these are both changing and we have these new rules that we're going about with titles and examples, we're actually going to rethink the entire fatal versus non-fatal error process and what actually counts as a fatal error. I can still tell you for sure that any sort of missing signature, missing date, those will still make the form invalid. So that will mostly be the same. But anyone can contact me with questions about that. I am going to send out a list when it's completed of all of the different rules for what makes the form invalid. I also feel that the rule of making non-fatal errors into an 11 is not good practice, because if the form should actually be a 5 and it's changed to an 11 just because it's missing something, but all of the information is there, I don't think that that's a good idea. So what we're going to do is get rid of the rule that non-fatal errors, now called errors, will turn into an 11. The codes will only be changed when it's a discrepancy. So when the description itself differs from the code that's been selected. And it looks like we have a question.
Three.
Will those invalid forms count against your percentage you need to quarterly to submit a claim? Yes, invalid forms do count against your participation. So if you are a smaller school district, that can be huge for you. So we really want to make sure that we're very careful looking at the forms. Like I said, the main things are missing signatures and missing dates. Those are huge things that you can catch easily. Another example of an invalid form is someone who didn't actually fill the form out. Those are all things that should be caught. We should not have invalid forms anymore. That's what we're trying to work toward. We want everyone to meet their participation. We will definitely get the benefit of the doubt. Go ahead, Ann.
Can I add to that? That's where the importance of having the correct school hours. So if you are a small district and you only get, 10 forms or 3 forms or 2 forms, you want to make sure probably when you get your list or get the moment electronically, however you're getting them, that you review that and make sure that those, and it's easier to do if you only have a few, to check and double check those times and make sure that they're.
Right. And if it is a 13 and that position is vacant, then we would expect it to be blank, just to clarify
right.
on that. Like, we wouldn't expect to see any sort of description there. If it is a 12 and it's their day off, we just expect to see, it's my day off. We don't need any additional information. I do see that we have some additional questions. And these are going, it looks like both of them are going back. The first one that I see is, if attending an IEP meeting is not program planning development code 9, it should be non-Medicaid, other educational code 11. An IEP meeting is always going to be an 11. Always.
And just for clarification, a code 9 would be program planning not related to a specific student. That would be, an example would be, you know, when people are meeting and they're planning out how they're going to implement a program, that program planning code 9 is never related to just one student. Is that correct?
Yes, that would improve delivery of services for students as a whole.
Right. Thank you.
Whereas a 5 is always going to be about an individual student. You are helping that student get the services that they need. Now, unfortunately, federal guidance says the IEP is educational. So we have to make sure that IEP meetings and anything related to developing an IEP, that's writing the IEP, meeting about the IEP, having the IEP meeting, is going to be an 11. Now, if you are working on coordinating the services that a student needs outside of the actual IEP planning, it's a 5.
Thank you. And that's a very, very important thing to note. So thank you.
Absolutely. And then the other one that I'm seeing is it shouldn't be reopened to the participant to make changes, only for the district manager to make comments or clarifications from a participant in order to code correctly. Yes. Electronically. Yes. But I can see how if you had a paper form and someone had written something that and they had signed for it, there would still be an opportunity for you to send it. I mean, There could be an instance with a paper form where it might actually need to go back to the participant if it has something to do with their signature, for example. You wouldn't be able to sign for them. So, I mean, from my point of view, I would see how with a paper it might actually have to go back. But electronically,
Leela, just to clarify that for an electronic form, once the sample participant has submitted it and the 7 days are over, it is never to be commented on by the sample participant again.
Well, if you need to get additional, the sample participant will not have access to it, but if you need additional information clarifying their activity, and by clarifying, I don't mean adding to, I mean clarifying their activity, you could add a note. Like, for example, if they said, I was in a training. Well, what training was it? We need to know what training it was, because it could have been a medical training if they're a medical professional. And then it could be a 7. It could be related to child health checkup. So you would need to contact that participant and say, what was your training? And then make a note, the participant was in a medical training, or the participant was in a CPR training. And then we would know, oh, okay, it's supposed to be an 11.
So it would not be the sample participant that you're saying a sample participant can never go in after that 7 days. Any additional clarification
right.
would have to be provided by the district person.
Right. It'll be the same.
And that communication has to happen outside of a system. So if you have a built-in comment system on your form where the actual responses are not unlocked to the participant, they can see what they typed, and there's an additional text field for them to write the clarifying comment. You're saying that's not appropriate, that should happen either through email or over the phone, and the district contact then enters it.
I'm saying that the original moment that the participant entered cannot be changed and that comments can be added.
Okay, thank you.
There's a time where there is to add comments. It cannot ultimately change the participant's entire statement. It cannot fully add to it, but it can clarify it.
Okay. So what you're saying cannot be changed, just for clarification, after the 7 days is up, is answering those questions of who were you with, what were you doing, what they originally put in as what they were doing. That's what can't be changed.
Yeah.
Right. But
after 7 days. Okay. Thank you.
Karen Thomas.
It looks like we have another question being typed in right now. Will the district have the access to unlock the participant's moment? That's going to be a question to discuss with your consultant. And clarification should be put in the notes or comments section. Yes.
And then Karen Thomas.
And then, oh, I'm blind. Let's see. OT writing evaluation reports that will be used in the IEP meeting. Anytime a medical provider is working on a medical service, it is direct service. So if they provided an evaluation for a child, an evaluation is a direct service. Any paperwork related to that direct service is also included in Code 10. So writing an evaluation would be Code 10, because it's related to the direct service that was provided, which is the evaluation.
Okay, maybe we can go ahead and finish the monitoring update and then catch up on the questions in a little bit.
All right, so the certified school match or fee for service monitoring tool is going to change a little bit as well. Previously, it was a written report that came as a letter. I'd like to make that more clear and just have a very simple met or not met, rather than having to read through everything that you know you've already submitted. I'm just going to have each section that's required and whether it was met or not met. It will be easier to look at and provide a better at-a-glance report of how you did on your fee-for-service monitoring documentation requirements. Then the next part we're going to talk about is, everyone knows by now, we're doing an annual fee-for-service Medicaid certified school match monitoring. That means we are looking at two claims per service type once a year. So what I've been doing is I'm pulling the first half of the year and the second half of the year at this point. So that means that this monitoring could run all the way into 2020, depending on when you look at, whenever you submit your claims, because I want to make sure that I have a really good picture of all the claims that have been submitted. The turnaround time is going to be longer. I am working with all the districts in the state, and administrative claiming does take a lot of time, as we all know. So I will get them back to you as soon as possible. I try to contact everyone as soon as I receive their packet and let them know, and I go ahead and complete a short questionnaire with them just to make sure we have everything. But I will keep you all updated, and you will be seeing those reports as soon as they are completed. If you have any questions, if you want to check on the status, feel free to call or email me. The other thing I want to mention that was actually in one of the earlier slides from Marty that we skipped past is AAC claims. Several districts have had an issue because of where AAC claims are located in the fee schedule. The claim is being put in accidentally as AAC when they mean for it to be a regular OTPT or SLP claim. If you find that you have an AAC claim that is not actually AAC, please check all of your AAC claims. Make sure that they are correct. There's always a possibility for ad hoc requests. We want to make sure that they're all correct in the system. If it is not an AAC claim, please void the claim and resubmit. And like Marty said, we have staff here. You can contact a recipient provider assistance, and you can be assigned a claim specialist who can help you with that process if you need it. If you realize that one of the claims that I've selected was made an error, for example, I selected an AAC claim, it's not actually AAC, please let me know immediately. And go ahead and void that claim and send me proof that the claim has been voided. And I think that's it for my section, if no one else has any questions.
Okay, I'm looking at the questions. The remaining questions that have come in have been specific to the EMACs or the districts that are using vendors for admin claiming. So I think I can speak for all of us that our operating systems will be back in touch with our districts to give them any further guidance as a result of these changes. So I'm going to move on to Senate Bill 290 and House Bill 587. These are identical bills that are out there. Currently, the current situation, and I know I did the bill analysis for DOE, and Matt over at AHCA did, you all know Matt, did the bill analysis, I believe, for AHCA, or parts of it. So anyway, the current situation is that Florida statute allows for schools, private schools, and charter schools to seek Medicaid reimbursement only for IEP or IFSP and a certified match for those services. So there are bills out there. The Senate bill, I believe, was sponsored by Senator Montford. I'm not sure who, I don't have it right here, who sponsored the identical House bill. But anyway, it allows for alignment with the Medicaid state plan amendment that's going to allow districts and charter schools to seek reimbursement and certified match for the upcoming rule that we expect to come out at some point that changes our program to add these services outside of the IEP or IFSP. There's a requirement right now in 409-907-1 Florida statutes, and the 409 statutes are Medicaid statutes. Right now, there's the requirement that certified funds, that's our certified match, is only available for those services to students with IEPs and IFSPs. And I'm paraphrasing there. It talks about IDEA Part B or whatever. So it deletes that requirement that the certified funds are only available, because this is opening it up for the implementation of what we've always called free care, where districts will be able to bill for services provided to Medicaid recipients who are students that we're not sure. We know in the draft rule that AHCA has put out there that we've all commented on, would require a plan of care, some type of medical plan of care. So it provides an effective date of July 1 of 2019. So there was a feeling when there was a study that was done, and someone looked at the statute and said, even if this policy had gone into effect a few months ago, you know, there was the feeling that the statute had to change because it really didn't allow for the certified match for anything other than the other services. So that's being worked on. So the current status is the Senate bill's been referred to these three committees you see on the screen, or committees and subcommittees, and then the House bill you can see. I keep up with this. Nothing's been agended as of like 2 days ago on any of these committees to hear the bill. So that's where we are with that. Then we have our contact information for AHCA, and we have the contact information for us on the next slide. We've got a couple more questions that we can answer, but I just want to let everybody know after the call, I've never recorded one of these calls, so we will get the recording out, the PowerPoint. The things we will get to you are the PowerPoint, a link to the recording. I'm going to send you the AAC example procedure that I referred to earlier, and I'll also send out the CMS guide that most of you probably have it, but if you don't, I'll include that as an attachment in the email as well. We will not, because we recorded, we will not be sending out notes as we have in the past, because you will have the recording. So that's all we have from here, but let's go back up to a couple of questions. Karen said, can anyone elaborate on the alert that came out yesterday regarding HCPCS update? Can you all check on that, Marty, to find out I was actually going to look and see if there was anything with those HCPCS, because I know some of our codes are HCPCS. And will you let us know if anything's affected that, or let me know and I can get that out to the districts?
Sure can.
And Paula, yes, I think I just addressed, we will get all this out to you. Again, you're going to get it a lot quicker too, because it's going to, usually we wait for the notes and, you know, I do those here and send them to AHCA, and everybody who participated from AHCA or here at DOE on the call, you know, we had to kind of get everybody to fill in the blanks, and because, you know, so this is going to be a lot better having this. And then we'll also post everything on our website. I would encourage you, since there that, you know, today we didn't just get clarification, changes were discussed, that you make sure that this information gets to people in your district who need to know this, because a lot of times we'll only have one person on a district. And again, Chris and Sam, I know people from Civic and Excelify and us will be getting in touch with districts that we deal with on SDAC to provide some clarification and moving forward. And so can I ask, Leela and Amy, if questions come into you that you answer, if you would forward those to me, and or maybe we could just keep a list of questions as people are implementing these changes that, you know, we could periodically send out to the districts so they can,
sure,
you know,
thing. We'll
not have to ask the same question. Any clarification that's provided, that would be great.
Sure, we'll see you on our response.
Okay. Broward asked, do we have a carve out from the managed care orgs? I'm not sure what you're asking, because we don't call it a carve out, but we are not included. Are you talking about something new or the way things are and have always been? Okay, Broward's typing, and this will be our last question, I believe. And we want to thank you all. We had a big turnout for this call, which is good. The question is, Medicaid requires non-ESE students to bill through managed care. Our program is outside of the managed care requirements. That's why when we had the issue a while back that we addressed, where Sunshine Health and a few other managed care, the managed care organizations operating in your district, were contacting you, because since these services are not part of the managed care and are outside of the managed care, they are supposed to contact school districts and try to coordinate services or get information on coordinating services.
Right.
So, because that's what managed care is all about, is a coordination of care. There's a question, July 2012 Medicaid handbook outlines mandatory assignment for managed care. We need to have a carve out. I'm not sure. Maybe you could send that directly to
Ann. If you were to go out to the SMMC core contract, and
right,
there's a section there, and I think I've already, you know, given it to you before.
Yeah, we sent it out to all the districts. We sent that information out.
Who can and who can't, and under who can't or who's exempt, it's this program. So
right.
Just to elaborate a little bit more, the contract also required all of the plans to reach out, just like you said. But that's all it is just reaching out in an attempt to coordinate services. It has nothing to do with anything else.
Thank you. And Broward, I just don't know where you're referring to the 2012 Medicaid handbook. The fee-for-service is 2005, and the general handbook. Okay, yeah. Now, as Marty said, and as we get sent out to districts a while back when these questions were coming up from managed care organizations, we've never called it a true carve-out, but it is, and I'm not going to use that word, but it is, as Marty just said, Okay, well, thank you all. Is there anything else you need to add? Go ahead, Marty.
No, I was saying exempted sounds like a much nicer way of putting it rather than carve out.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, do you have any more comments, Akka? We're good here.
We're good here. Thank you very much, for everybody, for participating.
Thank you, and we'll get this information out to you very quickly. Thank you all, and have a great day and a great next couple of months. Thank you.
Thanks. You too. Bye-bye.